Welcome back to Murderlicious. I'm Lindsay.
And I'm Lauren.
This week, in honor of Valentine's Day, we're going to tell you the story of a Valentine's Day murder from 2007. Just a warning here. This case is extra sad and morbid. But before we get into the events that happened on the tragic 2007 Valentine's Day, first we want to introduce you to a beautiful soul named Jodine Elizabeth Sarin. Jodine, who went by Jody, was born in Glendale, California on November 21st, 1967 to her parents Arthur and Lois Sarin. Jody had some slight mental developmental disabilities, but was very high-functioning. For example, she was able to live independently on her own later as an adult, but she needed help with some things like getting rides to places because she didn't drive on her own. She had a brother named Michael and three sisters named Nancy, Barbara, and Carol. She might have also had another brother too. It's not clear from her obituary, but from her obituary, I knew that she did have a handful of brothers and sisters, so I might have missed one, and if I did, I apologize. Jody grew up in Walton Hills, Ohio, and graduated from Bedford High School in 1986. At some point after high school, Jody's family moved to Carlsbad, California, which is a city near San Diego, so on the water in California. Since she loved making flower arrangements, Jody earned a certificate in floral design. Jody was beautiful and so sweet. Nancy Grace reported that Jody would respond to emails and letters in poem. Jody loved animals, especially Sam, her gentle white horse, and her beloved cat, Angel. She enjoyed horseback riding, ice skating, biking, crafts, and kayaking, and found peace and comfort in taking long walks along the beach. All of her siblings eventually married, so Jody had a big supportive group of brothers and sister-in-laws and was a proud aunt to a bunch of nieces and nephews. Jody loved helping others, especially homebound senior citizens. She enjoyed volunteering at her church and the Humane Society. And Jody was grateful for the support from the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. She was an enthusiastic walkathon fundraiser for various groups each year, and she treasured the time she spent with her friends at Mariposa and the Copper Hill Friends Group.
So fast forward to Valentine's Day, which was on February 14th in 2007, when Jody was 39 years old. Jody's parents, Arthur and Lois, and Arthur went by Art, so we'll call him that for the rest of the episode. They went to dinner and a movie for a date to celebrate Valentine's Day together. And Lois, Jody's mom, was having a really good time at dinner, but she couldn't seem to shake the feeling that something was really wrong because they hadn't heard from Jody all day. As we said earlier, Jody was very high-functioning despite her disabilities, and she even lived independently at a condo that her parents had purchased for her. She did rely on her parents a little bit for some things. Like we said earlier, she couldn't drive, so her parents took her to and from doctor's appointments. But she usually spoke to her parents every day. And Lois had a really uneasy feeling because she hadn't heard from Jody since the night before, which was February 13th. So once the movie was over, Lois and Art left the theater at around 10 p.m. and decided to go drive by Jody's condo on their way back home to check on her. Jody's condo was on the ground level at Swallow Lane in Carlsbad. So Art and Lois went to Jody's condo and they knocked on the door, but there was no answer. But luckily they had a spare key, so they tried to go inside, but the door was locked on the inside with the chain on the latch. All of the lights were on, so they called her name through the cracked door and there was no answer. So they got really concerned and Art forced the door open and he ended up breaking the lock. Lois said that the lights were on and everything seemed normal. They were kind of thinking that maybe she was in bed or in the shower. So they went to her bedroom and pushed the door open. Art and Lois saw a partially naked man on top of Jody in her bed. And they thought that they were interrupting an intimate moment and they were pretty embarrassed. So they rushed outside to another part of her condo. And Art told the man to get dressed and get out. He did think that he was interrupting something between his daughter and maybe a boyfriend that he didn't know about, but he was also a little bit worried that the man could have been taking advantage of Jody because of her vulnerabilities. And after a few minutes, Jody and the man were still not coming out of her bedroom. So Art and Lois knocked on her bedroom door, and there was no reply. So they slowly opened the door, and they couldn't believe what they saw.
What did they see when they opened her door?
The man was gone and Jody was lying naked and motionless in her bed. Art put Jody on the floor and he began CPR, but it was far too late because her body was already cold. This means that she was killed hours beforehand.
Wait, so where was the guy?
Hold on, I'll get there. Jody had been bludgeoned and strangled, and the autopsy said that she died of blunt force trauma to the head. So the man that Art and Lois saw was her killer, and what was happening wasn't an intimate moment. It was necrophilia.
Oh my gosh, necrophilia. So he was having sex with her dead body?
Yeah.
Oh my God. Where'd the guy go?
So when Art and Lois went to the other part of the condo when they were embarrassed, they were in an area where they couldn't see the bedroom door or the front door. So this meant that the killer had probably snuck out the front door without them even noticing. The description that Art and Lois gave to the police was that this man was white, he was in his 30s, and he had brown hair. During the investigation, the police were not able to find an entry or exit point because no windows in the bedroom were broken or forced open. There was no sign of forced entry at the door.
Except for when Art broke it down.
Right. So no forced entry indicated to the police that Jody knew her killer, or maybe he was using like a ruse of some sort.
Yeah, like pretending to be like the cable guy.
Right. So that's kind of the only thing that they thought would make sense for him to have gotten inside, that she willingly let him in. And nothing was missing, so it wasn't a robbery.
There was a pair of men's shoes found by the front door that did not belong to Jody, and it was suspected that they were left there by the killer. And this also indicates that the killer either knew Jody or that Jody invited him in, because she probably was like, sure, come on in, but please take off your shoes.
There was also unknown male DNA found at the crime scene, but there were no matches when they entered the DNA into CODIS. But the Carlsbad Lieutenant, Kelly Kane, said that it is enough evidence to identify someone if they had a match. So they had the DNA, they just didn't have anyone to match it to.
I wonder if the DNA was only semen or if it was also blood, because it sounds like it was a pretty bloody crime scene. And I also wonder if Jody's parents, like, saw them covered in blood.
So like I said, the police were quick to assure that she had likely known her killer. And Jody's neighbor, her name was Samantha, she told police that she saw a man running down an embankment near her apartment on the night that Jody was murdered, but he was running so fast that she couldn't see his face. And Jody's dad, Art, told the police that he thought that he recognized the man as somebody that Jody knew through her circle of friends. And if it was this man, he didn't have a car. He used public transportation or rode a bike. So this makes sense why the man that her neighbor saw was running away. Like, he didn't have a proper getaway.
Like, his car wasn't parked out front, and that's why she saw him running where she saw him?
Yeah.
Okay.
But when this man was identified, he did provide a DNA sample, and it didn't match what they found at the crime scene.
So it was just someone that looked like him.
I don't know if it was someone that looked like him, or since Art just got such a quick glimpse, he thought, like,
maybe he'd assumed,
like, this has to be someone that she knows.
Right.
But it wasn't him.
So 10 years passed and there are no suspects.
But forensic science came a long way during those 10 years, from 2007 to 2017. So in 2017, DNA technology Parabon Nanolabs, they transformed the genetic material found at the crime scene into a digital image. And this is a process called DNA phenotyping. You might have heard of it, but if you haven't, it's a process that basically uses unidentified DNA left behind at a crime scene, and they take that and produce a picture by predicting someone's physical appearance.
Their skin color, their eye color, their hair color, their gender, their ancestry, their face shape, etc. You guys might have heard about this because they use it in the Golden State Killer case. So according to the analysis, Lauren, what did the police think that this guy looked like?
So based on the phenotyping, this is what they think their suspect looked like. He probably had fair to light skin, green or blue eyes, blonde or brown hair, and some freckles. He was likely in his 30s or 40s and of Northern European descent. And according to Art and Lois, the man that they saw in Jody's bedroom was a heavyset man with a large stomach and disheveled hair. They thought that maybe he was about 5'8 to 6 foot.
So for 11 long years, Jody's case went unsolved. And finally, in November 2018, the police announced that they had their guy. His name was David Aaron Mabrito. He was found using software that uses DNA and genetic ancestry to recreate composites, like Lauren explained earlier, and Mabrito's relatives' DNA were in the database, so that by process of elimination, the police were able to figure out that it was him. Unfortunately, however, there would not be any arrest, no trial, and no conviction. Mabrito was dead. He committed suicide on January 30th, 2011, almost 4 years to the day after he murdered Jody. And we're not sure exactly how he died, but it may have been an overdose, but it was said to have been suicide. What's really crazy is that it turns out that Oceanside Police Department actually had an unprocessed sample of Mabrito's DNA. They had pulled Mabrito over at a traffic stop, and because he matched the description of a suspect in a robbery, they obtained his DNA, but they ruled him out and didn't enter the DNA into any databases because they ruled him out as the robber. We're not sure if they ever discarded that sample, but we do know that since Mabrito was cremated after he committed suicide, they were not able to get DNA from his body, so they needed to talk to his family in order to confirm this match. More on that in a minute. First, let's talk a little bit more about who David Mabrito was. David Mabrito was 38 years old at the time of Jody's murder. He was 42 when he committed suicide. According to his obituary, he was born in San Antonio, Texas, and he lived in Oceanside at the time of his death. His memorial service was held in Carlsbad, so near where Jody was killed. He was married at one point, and he had a son. He had gotten divorced 1 year prior to Jody's murder. And apparently he was a tile contractor, but I'm not sure exactly. According to Nancy Grace, Mabrito had a meth problem and couldn't hold down a job. He was referred to as a transient by police and in news reports, but we do know for sure that he had family living in the area near Jody's murder. Mabrito had been questioned by the police in the past for an unrelated robbery case, like I said earlier, when his DNA was taken but never entered into any databases. Other than that, I was unable to find any other police records for Mabrito. I did see a case from, I think it was like 1992, but I couldn't get any of those records, and I have no idea what the charge was because it was so long ago. I can't access that online. In 2018, police approached Mabrito's ex-wife and his son and told them that Mabrito could be responsible for Jody's death, and they were shocked. But they agreed to give Mabrito's son's DNA as a sample to see if Mabrito was a match to Jody's killer's DNA. Mabrito's ex-wife was shown a photo of shoes from the crime scene, and instantly she recognized them as her ex-husband's shoes. His ex-wife said she is glad that they have answers now as to why he killed himself, because they had no idea why he did, and she blamed herself for his death for many years. Because Mabrito's ex-wife and son cooperated and gave DNA, they were bullied for months after they cooperated. They had to shut down social media accounts and turn their phones off, and reporters were knocking on their door harassing them, which is why we're not saying their names now, to protect their privacy. They were given the Citizens of Courage Award in 2019 for their help. The San Diego District Attorney's website states, "In spite of the likelihood of substantial negative consequences, this mother and son demonstrated extraordinary moral courage by providing DNA to investigators working to solve a cold case homicide." There is a video interview of Mabrito's ex-wife and son talking about how they found out about Mabrito being the killer and their reaction, and it was really hard to watch because they are also victims. They lost their loved one too. And first they had to deal with the fact that he committed suicide and they never knew why. And then when they found out that he was a killer and killed this beautiful, amazing young woman for apparently no reason, we never figured out the motive for the murder, right, Lauren?
Yeah.
So to find out that your dad killed himself would be hard enough to deal with, but then to find out he's a murderer, and such a heinous murderer too, like he killed somebody with mental disabilities in such a horrible way and then had sex with her dead body, it's just awful. Lieutenant Greg Corrin said that the department is sure that Mabrito is the suspect and is Jody's killer. His DNA was matched to evidence found at the crime scene, and the likelihood that someone other than him was the killer is 1 in 64 quintillion. And that's a number with 18 zeros, I think. A lot of fucking zeros. Police don't know if Mabrito and Jody knew each other, but they don't think that they did because they didn't find anything to indicate that the two ever crossed paths. So the nature of their relationship and how they crossed paths is unfortunately gone with the people that are involved. And another unanswered question is the motive. So, Lauren, how do you think that they even met? Maybe he was doing tile work in her condo or in the condo down the hall. If he was a tile contractor, then he could have been doing a renovation at another condo and saw her and, like, stalked her.
I just think that it's so crazy to think that this is the first crime that we know of from him.
Right, like, it's such a brutal and heinous crime, and to be capable of doing that to somebody else, it's hard for me to believe that this is his first crime, too. I wonder if there's other unsolved similar cases that he could be matched to. Like, to do your first murder, like, your first felony is, like, killing someone and then raping their dead body. That's pretty... It could be possible that he didn't kill her. He just raped her dead body. Like, he stumbled upon her dead already and...
Like, what are the chances? You know? Like, that just doesn't make sense. I mean, what I do want to know is we know that she was killed by blunt force trauma to her head and she was strangled, but we don't know what the murder weapon was.
Right.
We don't know how many times she was hit. We don't know if she was hit with a fist or with an object.
Right. We don't know if the crime scene was, like, super bloody and he would have had blood all over him.
We don't know if there was, like, no blood at all and it was maybe, like,
a closed head injury.
Right.
Yeah. Well, so the parents walked in on them and they didn't notice blood everywhere, but maybe it was dark inside.
Or maybe it was, like, yeah, I mean, it was 10 p.m., and maybe the angle of the bed, like, maybe when they walked in, like, her bed was facing the door, so they just saw him.
Right. And they were probably like, woo, woo, sorry.
Yeah, whoops. Yeah.
Yeah, and, like, rushed out and didn't really look.
Right. From what I can gather, they were super embarrassed because they were like, oh, my gosh, what an invasion of her privacy. We just broke down her door and walked into her bedroom, like, thinking she wasn't okay, but she's having an intimate moment with maybe her boyfriend. Like, they had no idea what they were walking into, and... I mean, I'm sure if they knew what was going on, they wouldn't have just walked into another part of the room and waited for them to come out. So I don't think they had any idea that that was how it was going to end up.
They're really lucky that Mabrito didn't charge them and, like charge at them and, like, come at them and, like, hurt them.
Right. I think it's so wild that they just happened to be in a part of the condo that they couldn't see the front door, and he just snuck out.
Yeah, he was a lucky... Like, if he's going to sneak out, though, why wouldn't he grab his shoes real quick? I wonder if the witness that saw someone running, if they saw someone barefoot running.
I mean, the witness said that they were running so fast that they couldn't see their face. I'm not sure that they would look at their feet.
Yeah. I feel so horrible for Jody's parents because they were doing everything right. Like, they... set Jody up so that she could have, like, her own independent life, but still were, like, helping her and being, you know, really, like, they didn't want to treat her like, do you know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, they didn't want to treat her like something was wrong with her. She had her own place.
Right, they wanted to encourage her independence, but they also wanted to protect her, and that's exactly what they did, and they must have felt horrible. Not only that it happened to her, but they, like, had to walk in and see it. Like, that's just awful. And on Valentine's Day, too. Like, terrible.
They weren't, like, parents that just kind of ignored the situation. They talked to her every day. They saw her almost every day. And the one day that they didn't hear from her, they rushed over there immediately. Like, despite it being Valentine's Day, like, a night out for themselves. Like, they were so worried that they went straight to her place to check on her.
Right. And it's like the mother's intuition that she, like, Lois knew that something in her gut was telling her that something was wrong.
Another thing that's so crazy is that since her body was already cold, like, we have no idea how long he was in there doing things to her.
Right.
And I don't know how quickly she passed.
Well, we do know that it wasn't more than 24 hours because they had spoken to her the night before. So it had to have been sometime within 12 hours. But I don't know how quickly a body goes cold. I mean, this is San Diego. It's not like a cold climate.
Yeah. And also, I think it does take a while. Like, it's not like they walked in and he didn't kill her because they walked in.
Right. And also, do we think that he stayed in the apartment, like he killed her and then stayed there for hours and raped her the whole time? Or do you think like he left and then came back? That's pretty brazen to murder someone and then stay at their house all day long. And I wonder how long he was planning to stay if he hadn't gotten interrupted. Like, what? Like, who knows? Like, I don't know if he didn't know her, then he might not have known that she had parents that would come check on her.
And since she was so high functioning, I mean, I haven't found anything online about, like, the nature of her disability or what exactly she had. Like, he might have not known that there were people coming to check on her constantly.
Oh, like, her disability might not have been obvious to someone that didn't know her. And on the flip side, if it was obvious, that's even worse that he would be...
It was, like, an easy target.
Right. This case is just so terrible. I feel so bad for her parents and her family and her. And I even feel bad for Mabrito's ex-wife and his family, because everything that I've read, and there's not much on this case, but everything that I've read and seen indicated that Mabrito's family was absolutely shocked. They had no idea that he would be capable of doing this.
There used to be a lot more information on a website that was dedicated to her cold case, but it's no longer up because it was solved, and it was called JodineSarin.net. We did use...
the Look Back Machine.
Yeah, it's like a website called archive.org, and we got to look a little bit at the website where you can go in, type like an old URL that doesn't really exist anymore and see what was on the website. We looked into it a little bit, but the only thing that we really could have access to was the homepage, which just had like an overview of the story. So we couldn't click on any of the links that had victim profile or crime scene. And unfortunately, there's just not much more out there.
If you guys are more internet savvy than we are and you are able to access more pages on JodineSarin.net that we can't find, send us an email to murderliciouspodcast@gmail.com, because I would really be interested in seeing that.
To avoid the horrific triggers of memories of what happened to their daughter, every year on Valentine's Day, Art and Lois Sarin leave Carlsbad, California. Jody was a woman with a gentle heart who loved helping others. Her family said, "Jodine taught us all with her special challenges, perseverance, and love of nature. There was joy in her laughter, love in her heart, and faith in her soul. Jody was an innocent victim of a senseless murder. The tragic and unforgettable circumstances of her death should not overshadow what a beautiful person she was. Her gentle heart and loving ways touched those who knew her."
We would love to hear what you guys think about this week's case. You can find us on Instagram at Murderlicious Podcast, or send us an email to murderliciouspodcast@gmail.com. We hope you enjoyed this week's episode, and we'll see you next week.